Profiles in Teaching with Technology is a podcast series created by Music First, a company dedicated to providing world-class cloud-based tools, content, and classroom management platforms to music teachers around the world. Each episode features a K-12 music educator who uses technology to enhance their teaching in innovative ways. We'll discuss the what, why, and how of their technology integration and hopefully share some teaching strategies that you can use in your own classroom. For more information about Music First, please visit www.musicfirst.com. There you'll be able to find out about all of our platforms, as well as sign up for a free 30-day trial. Dr. Peter Webster was a recent scholar in residence at the Thornton School of Music at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles, and is a professor emeritus of music education at the Beenan School of Music, Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He currently offers online courses in music technology and creative thinking in music for the master's programs at the School of Music, University of Florida at Gainesville. He holds degrees in music education from the University of Southern Maine and the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester. Webster was the 2014 recipient of the Senior Researcher Award from the Society of Research in Music Education of the National Association for Music Education. He is the co-author of Experiencing Music Technology, 4th Edition, a comprehensive textbook for college courses in music technology. He is also the author of Measures of Creative Thinking in Music, Version 2, a quasi-improvisational tool for assessing music thinking in music for young children. He has presented at many state, national, and international meetings and is a frequent keynote speaker. His published work includes 4 books and over 100 articles and book chapters on technology, music education practice, and creative thinking in music, which have appeared in journals and handbooks in and outside of music. He is an editorial board member for several prestigious journals and has served as an editor for special projects, including the MENC Handbook of Research on Music Learning, The Musical Experience, Rethinking Music Teaching and Learning, both published by Oxford University Press. He has served as an editor for the music technology portion of the College Music Society Symposium and for the music portion of the International Journal of Education in the Arts. It is my greatest privilege and honor to welcome Dr. Webster to the podcast this week. So this week on the podcast, I have an extremely special guest to me, one of my heroes in the music education and music technology worlds, Dr. Peter Webster. Peter, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast and share some of your wisdom with the listeners. I really appreciate it.
It's my honor. Thank you. I enjoy these podcasts over the years that you've done them. So I feel like I'm in rare company here.
Oh, that's very kind of you. The way I start off every podcast, and our listeners really enjoy hearing stories and hearing about the, you know, how you got interested all the way back to like when you realized, hey, I might like to be a music teacher. And then over your incredible career, you know, between Northwestern and USC and everything in between, if you could give us like the Reader's Digest version of your career, that would be lovely.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased to do that. It's a topic that I've been thinking about as I get older, about why it is that I am who I am. So this is a really good chance for me to kind of rethink about that. And I grew up in Maine. The state of Maine, Central Maine, Gardner Area High School. And for those of you, if you watch the show Maine Cabin Masters, which is on the Discovery Network.
My favorite.
you're talking about my neighborhood in the sense that almost all those episodes I'm Cobbessy Lake. You know, I see great. All the places that they tend to, anyway, so that gives everybody a sense of where my roots were. And like a lot of people, I began my fascination with playing a musical instrument. The trumpet was mine. And I started taking lessons in fourth grade, and I had a few private teachers and so forth. And that I had some success with that right away. And then enjoyed it so much, I wanted to do more. And so I did some conducting in the high school band. My old band director, Mr. Ronco, let me conduct the band arrangement of one of the Dvorak symphony movements, and I thought that was a great thing to do, and I got interested in that, and I began to teach privately on the side, and I began to realize that I kind of was good at trying to, I was good at figuring out what problems a student was having because I had been through it and struggled, and I identified, and it was fun to sort of solve problems. That's been something that I have really been interested along the way. So I went to the University of Southern Maine, which is now called, was called Gorham State Teachers College, but now is the University of Southern Maine, which has really changed a lot in the years. It's
Yeah, I was
tremendous.
there recently. It's a beautiful campus.
And they have a new building coming, and it's where Michelle Kashub and her husband Alan, and it's a wonderful school. And I had some good teachers there, I thought, history and theory, and a trumpet teacher who was mostly a jazzer, but that was okay because I learned something a little bit about jazz when I had him. So, yeah, so that was kind of the start. And then taught in the Ma Marshfield, Massachusetts school system when I first began my public school teaching. That's a little town that's south of, north of Plymouth. It's from the South Shore. And after a time there, I began to feel in my pedagogy that I was missing something. And I felt like it was a little hollow what I was doing. I didn't feel like I was really teaching much except mechanically how to play. And so that little trace has been through my life, that little sensibility that I have about more comprehensive music teaching, I suppose, started then. And so I thought I'd go off to graduate school, and so I did. And the school that I chose, I was lucky enough to get accepted into the Eastman School of Music, University of Rochester, which wasn't that far from New England. So off I went west. My career is west, 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 as I go on here. So I majored in trumpet performance and music ed, a double major and a master's, and then stayed on because there was an offer made for a doctorate, and I decided I would take the scholarly track because you could take the DMA track or the scholarly track. And I felt I was more effective after being around so many wonderful trumpet players. I realized, no, I'm not as good as I thought I was. So off I went to the more the academic side. And I did continue to teach there. I taught at the Wheatland Chi-Lai School Systems, and I also had a wonderful turn at teaching in a private girls' high school. Very interesting, near where Kodak was in Rochester. So that I continued to do a lot of teaching that way, and in my private lessons I taught and so forth. So then, as one goes through a doctoral program, you encounter the inevitable moment when you say, "Well, now what am I going to write about for my dissertation?" Right? Well, that same feeling that I had about just broadening and trying to make a little more complete the idea of how we teach music to everybody led me to wonder if there might be something more I could do with that. And so I took Paul Lehmann's standardized music assessment test class at that time. Paul went on from Eastman to be an associate dean at Michigan for years and years, and I still keep in touch with him. And he got me thinking about tests and measurements, and I began to read about assessment, and I began familiar. Of course, like that makes you familiar with all the standardized measures of music aptitude and achievement. And back then, during that time, those standardized measurement tools were much more in the venue of the minds of teachers than they are necessarily now. And I studied Gordon's music aptitude profile pretty deeply, and again, was struck by how great it was for creating a sense of how a student can be assessed for perception, that is, being able to do melodic and rhythmic distinctions. But I sat back and I said, well, now that isn't all of what kids do. I mean, they perform, they some of them improvise, they create. And so I walked into Paul Lehman's office and said, "I'd like to write an assessment of musical creativity." And he pretty
Wow.
much laughed me out the door. No, he was very supportive and said, "Well, that's never been done before, and so maybe you'd enjoy doing that," and so on. So my off I went to the Rochester University of Rochester's River Campus, which is where the main university is in Rochester, as the program with, and there was my first real encounter with a really good academic library, and so I became amazed at what had been done up to that point in psychology and education on the assessment of creativity in general. And that was the beginning. That was the time of Guilford and Torrance, and it was the beginning of that kind of that kind of movement in psychology where similar people were thinking about looking at imagination and that sort of thing as part of psychological stuff. So I got swept up in that and decided that I would write a dissertation on assessing high school students' musical creativity. And so that was my dissertation way back when. And so I came up with some tools that I thought did that, and I borrowed conceptually some things from the creativity literature, like divergency and convergent and divergent thinking, which still sort of is in my mind all the time, and several other things like elaboration and that began the wheels of in progress. So I finished that, and then my first college job was at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland. So you see, I'm
Hello.
still in the West, and started there. And in fact, there was an opportunity for me to think about how I could take my ideas about creativity, maybe in my scholarship, and actually do something with younger kids. So I created this MCTM, Measures of Creative Thinking and Music, which I still send out. I get that request for that thing at least once a month from some people,
Wow, that's
and
fantastic.
not so much in the United States. It's mostly overseas, which is kind of interesting. So anyway, off it goes, and I still have that as part of my quiver of tools that I send away. I don't. There's nothing. There's no money involved. I just send the thing off for them people to use. And that measure really helped me a lot in a lot of other ways, and it helped me start to think about other progressive ideas in music teaching and learning besides just assessment of creativeness. And that was when I was at CWRU, that was kind of like a formative time for me. And I was there 14 years, and that's where I met Bennett Reamer,
Oh,
and
wow.
he hi he hired me there. And I never forget my first interview with him. That was pretty frightening. But he liked what I said, and it happened to be that Eastman taught me well in music history. I took a cognate field in music theory. I'm sorry, music history, and they wanted at Case Western Reserve someone to teach music history courses for the undergraduates as well as music ed. So I began there, working with Bennett in a kind of a dual job, and then I eventually went over entirely to music education classes. But well, Bennett left to go to Northwestern, and I didn't hear much from him. And then one day he called me and said, "We need to have you out here." And I said, "Well, no, Ben, I love Cleveland. I do. I love that town,
Right.
and it's a good night, a good place." And he said, "No. You got to be in Chicago." So he is a pretty influential person. So
Yeah.
I decided I would, go out and interview there. And in fact, I took the job. And that began a 23-year time at that school that was a high mark in my life, because there were people there besides Bennett that were so powerful and so wonderful. I mean, it was a dream team for music education peoples. Carlos Abril was there, Maude Hickey was there, Janet Barrett. I'm just mentioning
Amazing.
names of people who now, of course, who are gone on to other jobs just like I did. But the point is, that was a period of time when we were able to attract a number of really smart people for doctoral students,
Yep.
and my proudest achievement, I guess, is to be part of their lives, because there are so many people out there who are a part of that Northwestern experience
Yep.
that I really loved it. Bennett had this idea of a center, and we met all as a group. A lot of doctoral programs do this now, as a group, and talk about it. You know, every Thursday, you know, someone would bring treats, and we'd talk about, and there would be, we'd do small projects, and it was a community of scholarship, which really impressed me at the time, and continues to be part of the way I think education should work. And we were doing interdisciplinary stuff, and so it was a real incubator, if you will, a real powerful kind of thing. And so when I retired from there, Rob Kudieta knew that I had had that experience at Northwestern and had knew my work, and he was a music educator as well as a dean at USC, and felt that I'd be a good match out there. And he also knew that I was a powerboater, a sailor, and he said, "You know, come on out here. I'll, you know, we'll get your boat out here, and you'll be, you know, I can't give you a tenured position, but I can give you something called a scholar in residence." Well, that's pretty cool.
Awesome.
So I convinced Connie that, okay, we pick my wife, we'll pick up and we'll head off to sunny California, which is where I live now. And I had 8 years, wonderful years of these half to, at half. What I had one of those years was a full-time job when they needed it, but I was largely doing much of the same thing as I did at Northwestern, and we worked on several programs, also great teacher students there and so forth. And I kept working on the subject of, by then I was expanding it myself into what the profession was interested in doing, which was also things like well, the philosophical basis for creativeness, and a little bit about the effect that it might have on social issues of how people feel about their job, and how they, you know, the constant perfection, the chase of perfection, and what that does for the psyche and the mind. So the human part was beginning to be of concern to me, and that, of course, was at a big part, even right now, of what USC is into in terms of the faculty that are there. So it was a good place for me to go. And then I can't seem to retire, so I'm now no longer teaching at USC, but I do two courses for Bill Bauer down at the University of Florida,
Oh, that's
Gainesville,
awesome.
the technology class and the creativity class. So those are the two poles in my life. So that's my academic story, where I began successfully playing the trumpet, enjoying it musically, loving it, and then all of a sudden realizing that there's got to be more to the teaching part. And then at the same time, I love psychology, and I loved ideas and the academic side, and that became interesting to me. Never was very good in math, but I was pretty good in statistics, and so I was able to figure out how I could do some studies as well as that. And I was always interested in qualitative work, which is another dimension of research that I've really come to enjoy. So that's my academic story. And then comes my interest in technology. And that was embedded in that, in the sense that while I was at in Cleveland, I bought my first computer, you know, the Apple eight, the old Apple II computer, the 8-bit computer was came out. And I was going to buy one of those, but then I saw this Franklin Ace. I don't know if anybody listening to this knows what that is, but that's a kind of a clone. That was a period of time when there were Apple IIe clones, and that was one that was out there. And I was attracted to that because I could not only run Apple software, I could also play around with some coding. I like to do ba learn BASIC and that kind of thing. So I got involved in that machine, and then. The fact that it made the Apple II made sound and four voices, and people were writing music software for that. I said to myself, whoa, you know, and one of the persons writing music software for that darn machine was Dave Williams, who will come into the picture a little bit later on. But anyway, I bought some of his software, and I popped the music card in the back of the Apple II, and I built an audio lab, or my first. I built two labs, one at Northwestern and one at Case Western Reserve, in the basement of one of those buildings that had a bunch of these Apple computers. And then also, there's a synthesizer called the Alpha Centauri that was at that time. And I started fascinated with that. And then they had a little system where you could plug a little card into that Apple and make the Alpha Centauri actually be a little composing station for you. And that was before MIDI, right? So that was long before MIDI. Not too long before MIDI, because it was like only in 1984 when the MIDI thing came out, which for me made a lot of sense. So that little lab at the basement of Hayden Hall in Cleveland became imbued with these workstations that had people playing around with not only Dave software for CAI, but also the prototype typical sequencing and notation software that was beginning to emerge at that time, which was really groundbreaking, I think, for the. So you see how this sort of embedded in my idea of teaching people more than just how to necessarily perform well, but also be able to maybe make a little music, a little improvisation, a little composition. So that was really powerful idea. Plus HyperCard,
Yeah, my
a
favorite.
whole little instruction kit that I became fascinated with as when I actually went to Chicago. You know, I met David because we did many, many, many appearances in the IMEA and Illinois Music Educator Association's state conference, which was very, very good. It had and it continues to be and has a contributions to Music Education Research Magazine and all that. Well, I got involved with him in giving talks. He would appear and I would appear, and we began to hit it off and talk to each other. Turns out that his background in Washington, University of Washington, Seattle, and my background at Rochester was similar in the sense that we were exploring things that were a little more progressive and kind of out there. When you talk to him, he'll tell you about that. But the point is, we really had kind of hit it off. We liked each other, and we liked each other so much we had a little thing for the ATMI CMS for a while, called a column that we were writing called Squeak and Blat. I was the
That's
trumpet,
right. I remember that.
and you remember that? And so we would. It was meant to be a takeoff on Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, which was a New England-based car radio show that was so clever. So
Yep.
we thought we were going to do the next Click and Clack, and well, it didn't work out that way. People didn't really take to sending us much. They, I don't have, I can't get this out. We thought we'd be problem solvers, right? We would
Right.
help to do that. But anyway, it was a fun kind of concept. But my point about that and with David is that we began to explore together and separately some of the ideas that we both believed in a lot, and we found that we were pretty compatible in terms of writing. So we began to write a little bit together, and then that led to my time at Northwestern. That led to the first issue of the Experiencing Music Technology book, which was then quite a breakthrough. We didn't nobody had quite a book like that at the time, so it was nice. Chance for me to work with him and get that going. So that's been the technology piece. We then went on and did workshops together, some of things. HyperCard was a big thing we talked about for the longest time because that was a creative construction kit
Yeah, it was
that
amazing.
it was really is, and it was predated the it was a little mini internet in a way, in the sense that you could bring all kinds of stuff together. And then the internet came, and that they no longer continued to make it. But and then the new, of course, the new Apple computer, the Macintosh, were began to make more and more sense as a computer to have. And so we all bought that and worked those things through. So during our time together, and it was has been about 35 years that we've collaborated. Was the construction of this book, but then all kinds of other. We did talks to NASM, which I will never forget, where the administrators gathered and we convinced them they needed to have a session on NASM, National Association of Schools of Music, have a session on technology. And so we opened the doors, I think, in some ways, to administrators who saw the need for things like labs and courses and that sort of thing. So we felt really pretty proud of that. And then
Absolutely.
yeah, and then the CMS ATMI Alliance has been ongoing. And so I think we've maybe given something like 39 talks to that combination,
Wow.
one nine way or the other. And we did pre-conferences with CMS ATMI and on topics, and it was a very nice partnership. That you know, and we continue to talk to each other and continue to and you know work the book and making that better all the time. So, the basic idea, I suppose, the last piece on the technology and the book, the EMT, that which is probably the best creation that we could have done together, was to create this notion of a comprehensive introduction to topics in music technology. So what we wanted to do was do the Donald J. Grout book of music technology. We
That's
wanted
great.
to, you know, when you read Grout's book, it's a blast through music history, and it's covers, and you know, to really know anything, you need to go deeper into Baroque music. You can't just read Grout. But the thing that we liked about that model was that no one had actually looked at historically the development of technology and saw the pieces coming together. The philosophy of constructivism, which I became very interested in, and how technology sort of gives root to that, the idea of you know, student learning, project-centered learning, all that stuff, seemed to be that people would need a kind of guide to that. So,
Absolutely.
yeah. So we decided that we would start talking about what are the competencies that we want in our music students, and then we began to think not just music technology students and music ed students, but all students who graduate as music majors, whether they're performance, therapy, or whatever, ought to have these 10 basic, you know, competencies. So we did a little work surveying our friends in ATMI CMS and asking them to come up with their nomination of what the 10, oh, what are the basic competencies? It began without stressing it had to be 10, but we wanted to know what they were, what people thought. So that is at the heart of most of our work on that EMT book, which is this idea of creating a little toolkit that people can start with. And then when they get really interested in, say, sequencing, and the difference between digital audio and analog audio, how they could learn more about that. So we include chapters on acoustics and the way in which the mind perceives sound, and then talk a little bit about the history and the development of MIDI and how that changed over time as being something very special in terms of how technology worked. And then every time we came up to a new chance to renew the book, there was something new. And so this latest one, we were so struck by the extraordinary development in mobile computing. So there's so much in that fourth edition that has to do with mobile computing. I mean, I learned all kinds of things about mobile computing that I never thought of. Some of the things that were happening in just taking an iPad and being able to create these extraordinary pieces of music with various cobbled together kinds of software together, create kinds of things that really opened up the field for people to sort of work through. So that's how the technology piece developed in me as an association with my deepest desire to try to create in the minds of people who want to teach music a more comprehensive idea of how we need to do our job better. And it's not that I abandon the performance piece and my love for Western art music. That's where I began. It's where a lot of us began, right? So you can't take that out of the mix at all. But there certainly is, as I've grown up and become more thoughtful about our field, this other world of music that is non-Western, that and this other way of making music called improvisation. The rest of the world does, and the United States doesn't do very well in their education system. And you know, talk to people around who are passionate about, I can think of three or four people in our field that are so passionate about improvisation, and their message is right. I mean, we need to sort of keep that. And the composition piece, you know, I've always thought it's great to study how kids think and sound, and then how they form their thought passages and how they revise. Do we, now the question is, do we ask our students to revise very much? Well, not really. Well, what about revision as a concept? And that's an important way that we are creative. We ch challenge ourselves to try to revise things. And how does that work? And where can that be in the curriculum? And all that sort of stuff. So, and so those the passion I had for creativity and creativeness. I like to call it creativeness or creative thinking rather than creativity, since that word gets abused. But the idea of creative thinking and the technology piece fits within that, and so do so many of the other important topics we can talk about in modern contemporary music teaching and learning that I feel is embedded within that. So I feel like I'm coming to the end of my career just when the profession is beginning to really recognize these things. So you always feel that way, I guess, when you get older, but it's.
But and I would say, sorry to interrupt you, but I would say that you have a lot to do with that, and you should be very proud of that, because there are so many music educators that I know who have been influenced by you and David and your approach to you specifically, your approach, with creative endeavors in the classroom. It had a tremendous influence on me. When I went to teachers college, I had Dr. Hal Abeles was my kind of my mentor there, and he spoke very highly of you, and you're very, very aligned in this kind of idea of assessment and creativity and technology. That's certainly what Hal was all about. But every paper I ever wrote, my own dissertation, your name popped up over and over and over, and I was like, this. And for those of folks who don't have Experiencing Music Technology, the book, and the fact that it's made it to a fourth edition is testament to just how important of a resource it is, because most music tech books are a one and done, maybe get a second edition. So for those of you that don't have, if you are a music educator, I'm going to pitch this for you, Peter. If you're a music educator, that book needs to be in your professional library, period. It, whether or not you're going to use technology as the main thrust of your teaching, or whether you're going to use it as a tool, which is the way I always used it, that book is this. It's basically the roadmap, in my opinion, for the effective integration of technology in music education. So, I just want you shared so much there. It's such a fascinating kind of, path that you took, and I think everybody loved hearing. I'm gonna switch things up here now and talk about, I taught at TC, at Teachers College, for 25 years, only graduate students, and this semester, Peter, I'm finally teaching undergrads, and it's a brand new experience for me. I am absolutely loving it. I'm with Dr. Brian Powell at the at Montclair State University, which is my alma mater, and I got to ask you this. What do you think? Because when I was president of ATMI for one term, and I was trying to make my platform the idea of a music tech course being required for all pre-service music educators and music teachers in general, what are your thoughts on the idea of, what should a music teacher, either pre-service or, in the trenches, what should they have in terms of tech? I mean, yes, everybody got a trial by fire in March of 2020 and like had to use it, kicking and screaming whether they wanted to or not, but that's not necessarily the best way to learn, or the best way for a long-term integration that's impactful. But I'd love to get your take on, why should music teachers learn music tech?
Because it affords an opportunity to give students agency, to give students freedom to learn with your help and guidance. It allows the engagement with music, either in the four ways we make music: music performance, music of performing the music of others is one, and then performing your own music, which is the improvisation piece, the music listening piece, and then the composition. Those are four ways. Those are the bedrock ways in which we as humans deal with music. And it occurs to me that because of that as a foundation, and because of what we know about how kids learn and how kids learn effectively, by using tools, like in this case, technological tools, where students can begin to construct their understanding of a particular love of something by looking at what's out there about them and figuring out how to talking with their colleagues, their kids, their peers about music. It provides a platform for just the way I think most scholars think people learn well, and that is to have this kind of framework where a project is suggested and help is given, but the student is given an opportunity to have some freedom, some ways in which they can learn best to be able to make that happen. And that touches on so many important ways that we are talking about music education today. Inclusivity, including people in our music classes who haven't started playing like I did trumpet in fourth grade and don't even care about trumpet in fourth grade, but they care a lot about sound and about music, and they actually are very smart about that sound. They haven't interrogated it, and that's our job to help them do that. But if we can help the students who are not necessarily in a traditional kind of way of becoming involved in music, we must, as music educators, music professors teaching other teachers to know how to teach, we have to get across this idea that we need to welcome in so many wonderful new ideas to pathways for people to learn music. Now, the criticism against this always is this: it's always we don't have time to do that, and we're going to be lowering our standards for Western art music. I fundamentally reject both of those ideas. And I can give you a handful of music teachers, some of them, many of which have appeared in your beautiful podcast, who have found the pathway to continue to celebrate Western art music. An oboe player can become a tremendous musician, continue that way, and still that oboe player can be creating raps, can be creating contemporary music, can be listening to that, understanding it, talking about it. There's nothing I have ever seen that suggests that a person has to be embedded in only one kind of style of music and only one kind of way of making that music happen. I mean, it has to change, or we're not going to be able to sustain music teaching programs. So the answer to that question is a profound one, and it's the one that I think is at the core of our field now, is that we need to use technology as an extraordinary tool, as an extraordinary tool to let and I can go on for hours about programs, many of which are available, when the music first whole idea, and then there's all the other programs that are outside of that. These are these tools that let students be able to craft their and work, and then they will be their own guidance. They know what they need to learn. They'll come to you and say, "What's going on here? How do I do these chords? And why can't my music sound the way that Pearl Jam sounds? Or I can't make my Well, that means we have to understand why and be able to, help them find pathways of soft, loud, high, low, fast, slow in ways that make the music sound a lot like all kinds of music that they're hearing. So this is I'm very passionate about this topic. I really think that all of the things that we're talking about now in contemporary music education scholarship, the stress on community music, the whole idea of student agency, about lessening the problem of making someone feel if they can't play perfectly, they can't make music. All of those things that sort of haunt us as being able to change the field. One of the key features of that is to understand how one can work with a online program to sort of put down some ideas and create what is a piece of music. And if a person doesn't play trumpet at the fourth grade, well, that's okay. You can start learning something else right away that is like that. And if you did start playing in the fourth grade, you can instantly see how you can take that training and that experience and make it work for you in many, many ways. But teachers have to just be, I think, and that, and that flows over. You mentioned assessment, the competency-based assessment and individualized instruction, and a whole idea of putting, I mean, this idea of a web quest where you actually, I talk about this in my course at Florida because it's in the curriculum there. But if you give students an idea of, okay, how can you write some, how can you put together the music of the expressionist period with the art was going on in expressionism? Can you create a little paper, but don't make it a paper, be make it a be a some kind of interactive multimedia thing that explains Jackson Pollock as opposed to what's going on in the field of music with Schoenberg and all. So there are these intersections of the arts that serve as a kind of wonderful framework. I mean, Janet Barrett has just written a new version of her interdisciplinary studies book, and it's just fantastic. I feel this is the way we need to be thinking. And technology is simply at the heart of that. AI is at the heart of this. I mean, you can ask AI to create a piece of music, create a picture that sounds like one is listening to Rimsky-Korsakov. And what can you and you can tell the prompts of the AI how to do that. And in comes this kind of image that, and then you interrogate that and say, well, that's not what really quite what I want. I wanted this kind of thing. And so AI enters the field now as an interesting tool. I like to call it IA, by the way. It's not new to me, but people have said that to me before. It's intelligence assisted, where you actually use the tools that are being developed, which are really tools that have been around a long time. Think of the way you actually look at database, create a, when you want to do a dissertation, you go to these indices and you put in these keywords and you look what people have written. Well, it's the same kind of thing,
Absolutely.
where we have these prompts that create, and then you interrogate what they are. So our AI thing can be our AI can be really and handle well if there are ways in which we enjoy asking students to be able to explain how they used it. What is it that they thought about it? What did they like about it? What have they discovered is wrong about it? So it's a tool that can be a terribly powerful source for teaching, I think. So I'm sorry, I get carried away on
No,
this.
I couldn't agree more, but you said something in there that I see. I know now my entire approach to teaching and listening to you, I can pretty much attribute it to, there's so I am so indebted to, because for everyone listening, this type of thought was not around before, Peter started talking about this, and I'm just so and I'm so honored to speak with you, and I don't mean it to be puffery. I really am.
No, oh,
Every
thank you.
word you're saying, I'm just like, oh my God, that's exactly. I can trace the way I teach to your thinking, but
Oh,
I
that's
do want
great.
to ask you this.
Yeah.
I think that whenever I talk to teachers, because I've been trying to get teachers to get their kids to do creative projects, to have them write music, to have them try out all the different tools by any means necessary, get these kids writing. Because when I did it with my students, I could see that this magical switch
Yes.
turned on. I saw it happen. I saw the kids, their eyes lit up like, oh my God. And then they wanted every other kid to listen to what they wrote. And whenever I talk to teachers about you have to experience, it's like one of the joys of teaching is to see this moment. They'd say, well, I'm not creative. They
Yeah,
have
well,
this kind of,
that's it.
you know what I mean?
It's about control. Teachers worry about losing control of what they do by allowing students to do this sort of thing. Like, I won't know how to interpret that, or wouldn't I don't know how to necessarily help a person. I think I'm losing. I can't. Where my what I've been doing all these years somehow is not being relevant to them now. Why I can't? So it's about losing control. And so,
100%. And it's the, to me, what I was, not only was I a music ed major, but I was a theory comp major. So I was actively composing. So when kids, it was kind of a natural extension of my teaching, to bring myself and my own interests into my teaching just to engage the kids. And when the kids would play something for me, and let's say that it had, what they played back for me wasn't necessarily musically everything. I don't know, because I find it very difficult to be critical of what a kid produces. And I felt that my role was always to have them, to draw out of them, to ask them questions that would might say, oh, wait, let me go try it. I would never try to imprint my own musical kind of creative efforts into the kid. I would say, all right, that's really interesting. What do you think you could do with a bass? Wouldn't it be cool if there was a bass part? And the kid goes, oh yeah. And I think a lot of teachers are uncomfortable with that kind of being critical of a student's creative efforts, which is a very, very dicey and thin ice kind of, I would never, that's like a terrible thing to tell a kid. That's, that's not so good. They'll never write anything again. But I think a lot of teachers are just fearful of that. And I couldn't agree more that it is a control thing and that it's almost as if just try it. And your natural reaction as an educator, as a trained, as an adult is to be like, to ask questions, right? I maybe not so eloquent on the way I'm putting it out there, but
Well, on that issue of criticism about, both Maude Hickey and Michelle Gashub and with Jan Smith have written, and so many other people have too, but those are two of the those are people that leap to mind. Wonderful guidelines about that, about how to think about that. And so I've learned so much from them just reading their words, and I think that that any creative act, it can be revised and worked on. And so our role is to make it better. But ask the student, how would you would like, what do you like about this and what do you not like about it? And how can I help you make it be something you really like? And it could be that there's a question you don't know the answer to and you can't seem to figure it out. You turn it over to the class and say, does anybody know how to make Sally's piece sound a little bit, like we're talking about? Because I can't quite figure out quite how to do it. And it's amazing how everybody will rally to Sally. I mean, there will be people who want to be able to help figure that out as a community of scholarship, which goes back to what Bennett did at Northwestern. I mean, it's just all it's a community of people sort of learning how to make that happen. So, yeah, absolutely.
So I'm looking at the clock, Peter, and I realize that I gotta squeeze in these last two questions, and I
Sure.
thoroughly appreciate everything you've shared. But the
Okay.
advice question, somebody who's had the career that you've had and taught as many people and taught some of the biggest rock stars that are out there as well. What advice would you give to a teacher who might be hesitant or not sure if what we saw at Music First is that during the pandemic, everybody was using technology because there was really no other way to connect with their kids.
Right.
The minute that they were back in person, many of them dropped it, never to use it again, even though they might have experienced something. But what would you, I mean, something good. What advice would you give to teachers who are thinking of incorporating music tech into their programs?
I would start with the music experience called music listening that we all have grown up with. It's probably the least well-taught pedagogy in the entire repertoire of American music education. This idea that you can interrogate what a person is hearing in the music, one of the ideas is what do you think you'd like to see in the future in music technology? It would be technology that would help us understand the music listening experience. And I'm talking not only about identifying structural aspects of the music, but getting much deeper into it, into the aesthetic idea of why music has the power that it does to us. What is it that's happening in the music that makes it so powerful? And there are so many wonderful pieces of music in all styles where it moves you to tears when you really listen. What is it about that? What is it that makes that work? So anything that we can do with the music listening experience as a start, I think, in terms of how we teach music to kids, put aside the teaching of an instrument, put aside the idea of teaching theory, put aside the idea of teaching music history, all in the abstract, and talk about the listening experience of what, and then begin to deconstruct that and understand why it is that Schubert has, or Debussy has the effect that it has on us, or that Billy Joel has the, what is it about that music that really speaks to us and makes us, and it gets the whole thing into the idea of, oh, one last idea I want to leave with everyone. When you teach a fact about music or a skill about music, always pair it with a creative act on the part of the student to be able to show they understand what you've said. So if you talk about syncopation, ask the person to write a small piece that has syncopation. If a person is talking about dominant seventh chords, write some dominant seventh chords. Do something creative that actually shows that the person has internalized the thing that they're so excited about. And often it will be a technology will play a role in that. And it will be, I suppose that's the pairing the creative with the technical is probably the best thing that I can say to everyone in terms of how to make things different.
I love it. So my last question for you, I'm excited to ask it, which is you've seen music technology from its really, in terms of it being used in schools, you've seen it from its infancy to now. And so you've really experienced, I mean, I experienced it as a kid. When I was, in elementary school in the late 70s, and we got our first pet computer, right? And I was in Gifted and Talented. It was like, oh, this is so cool. But I would love to know your magic wand, if you could just wave it and have music technology do something that it can't do now, what would it be?
It would be to feed into the system of whatever it is, a piece of music that one really loves, and have the technology come back in a way that explains what is happening with the music, not only technically, but also as an affective experience for us. The speed of the rhythm, the speed of the sound, the way the sound interacts with the rhythm, ha software that can somehow help guide our most inner reactions to music as art by trying to find clues to that particular kind of thing, and then offer an example of other pieces that might be doing that. I mean, that would be that ultimate intelligence, that ultimate way of sort of getting to the affective as well as the cognitive part of the music. Wow, would that be a
Yeah.
wonderful teaching tool?
Amazing. Well, we got to wrap up. We're out of time, but Dr. Webster, it's been really my honor, and on behalf of every music teacher listening, thank you
Okay.
for all the work that you've done over the years with creative endeavors, with technology and EMT. And I just can't thank you enough for being. I'm going to be out in LA for the APME conference in June, and I'd love to take you out to dinner. It's wonderful to chat with
Well,
you.
I'm coming to that, so it's a date.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Well,
All
again,
right.
thanks so much, and I wish you all the best, and I'll see you soon.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to Profiles in Teaching with Technology from Music First. For more information about Music First, please visit www.musicfirst.com. If you would like to stay up to date with other music teachers doing innovative things in their classrooms with technology, please subscribe to our podcast through whatever outlet you listen to podcasts on. Thanks for listening.